The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Welcome to the Thursday edition of Balance of Power here on the radio, the satellite, and on YouTube, where you can find us right now. Go to YouTube, search Bloomberg Global News. You'll find our live feed with breaking news. Dare to dream. Legislation has emerged after days of work in the House of Representatives. It landed at 3 o'clock in the morning. Did you feel a bump in the night? Here's what we've got. Six bills, $1.2 trillion, 1,012 pages. Of course, if they don't get this done, the government will shut down or partially shut down. Midnight Friday. And as we told you yesterday, if they follow the rules, that will happen. They're not possibly going to get this done with a 72-hour waiting period in the House, 30 hours of debate in the Senate. So now the question is, can Mike Johnson break those rules, set the land speed record required, send everybody home on recess for another 2 weeks? They call it the district work period, you know. And we start on Capitol Hill to get a sense of what's inside and what the chances are to actually make this happen with Eric Wasson, who broke this story, Bloomberg News congressional reporter. Eric, have you been up all night? Do they call you at 3 a.m. when this happens?
I did wake up shortly after 3 a.m. They told me it was going to come at 4. I set an alarm, but then I was, you know, nervous and I got up at 3. But, I mean, the story here today is jet fumes for the win. I mean, jet fumes in a recess tends to win. I think we're told Mike Johnson will, in fact, violate that 72-hour rule and put this up for a vote around 11 a.m. on Friday. We expect it to pass. It's under a two-thirds majority procedure. Lots of Democrats happy with this. I think probably more than half of Republicans. We saw with the first minibus, a six-bill package a few weeks ago, a surprising number of Republicans, more than a majority, voted for it. There's a lot of earmarks in here, a lot of pet projects. And Johnson's promoting to his people, it's a defense increase. You know, this is a 3% defense increase while domestic spending remains flat. This is all due to that debt ceiling agreement that we had last year, which was, you know, a big topic of our coverage. They came up with this budget caps, which, you know, they don't include, they preclude the rising in domestic spending that we saw under the early Biden years. They don't really cut too much. And that has conservatives fuming. You know, Chip Roy, one of the leading conservatives, which is on the Steve Bannon show, calling this an abomination. But he's not saying the motion to vacate. You know, he's not saying oust Johnson. So these guys are fuming. They're mad. That's $1.2 trillion. They're mad they don't get 72 hours, but they're not ready to take out the knives yet.
Yeah, that's right. We heard from Mike Johnson a bit earlier. He, of course, was probably up all night, kind of like you were. But he spoke to reporters shortly after, trying to frame this, of course, to the best of his ability. You're right. Conservatives feel like they lost some ground on this. Here's how the Speaker of the House sees it.
We've been very, very consistent, very adamant that we had to get our government funded. We had to get the appropriations process done. I'm delighted to tell you we're coming to the end of that, and we should have the bill text hopefully by this afternoon and begin to finish up that process. This is the second batch of bills. It includes the Department of Defense bill, as you know, Labor H, Ledge Branch, FSGG, SFOPs, and Homeland. That last piece, the Homeland piece, was the most difficult to negotiate because the two parties have a wide chasm between them, as you know.
That is right. We talked about it quite a bit. This is where things fell apart for a little bit, certainly got delayed over the weekend. Remembering DHS, Department of Homeland Security, is the border. Nothing easily around the border happens. What we have now, a 24% increase in DHS detention beds for migrants. That was a big sticking point. Funding for 22,000 Border Patrol agents. Eric Wasson, if we do skip the 72-hour rule and the Speaker loses the Freedom Caucus, will this still pass the House?
I definitely would pass. The Freedom Caucus, almost all of them, always vote no. In some ways, you could say they surrendered their power. But, you know, on the DHS spending, it's very interesting. 42,000 detention beds. That's less than the 50,000 detention beds that the Senate bipartisan Sinema Lankford compromise would have provided, that the Speaker torpedoed. Huh. And I, you know, I've asked Republican aides about this. You know, how can you call it a victory? I don't have a great answer. But I think they may come back and try to do some type of border deal later. I mean, the real answer is this is under budget cap. That emergency spending bill was not capped. But they are trying to claim a victory. You know, Democrats, meanwhile, are trying to jump support. They're very happy. They avoided a 22% cut to domestic spending that Republicans wanted. They got $1 billion more for Head Start and child care. You know, they did have to give on some things, including this provision that effectively bars the flying of the pride flag over U.S. embassies. You know, Democrats quickly point out it also bars the Confederate flag or MAGA, Make America Great Again flags. But this was really aimed at the pride flag because some embassies were flying that. And that's something that they had to swallow as part of this deal in order to protect the domestic spending that they wanted to focus on.
Fascinating. We've also got funding in here for new FBI headquarters, which is something that we've talked about a bit.
Yes.
on this program.
Huge victory. Victory for Steny Hoyer, Maryland Democrat, who not only snatched that away from Virginia, but protected $200 million in this.
That's something. Glenn Youngkin lost FBI headquarters and might be losing the teams here. Eric, I have to ask you lastly about the Senate. Is Rand Paul going to hold this up, or is this going to sail through? You said jet fumes for the win.
Well, you know, I just talked to John Thune, just running out on the outside with him. He says an amendment deal in the works. Hopefully they get this done on Friday in the Senate. So, you know, you could bet on jet fumes. It's more Mike Lee. He's very angry. He wants a stopgap bill to April 12th. He's going to try to get unanimous consent for that. He won't get unanimous consent. I think it's more how much he wants to dig in. The rumor is Rand Paul has a big event in Kentucky on Saturday. Susan Collins, unfortunately, her mother passed away. Her mother's funeral is on Saturday. There's a lot of personal considerations why people don't want to be here that are legitimate. I think it gets done Friday, but we'll see.
They call it the home district work period, right? Do you smirk when you hear that as opposed to recess? Or are lawmakers, I know I'm going off the track here a little bit, Eric, are lawmakers actually working when they're home?
I think, you know, generalizations are tough. Some are, certainly. Some are going on CODELs, investigative CODELs. These are trips to, you know, everywhere from Taiwan to the Middle East. You know, but some of the older, more retired members maybe just taking a little bit easy. We have a lot of octogenarians up here. I'm not sure that they're really pounding the pavement each day of the district work period. So you're right to be a little skeptical.
Okay, got it. It's great to see you again. Great reporting, Eric, and thanks for staying up for us. Eric Wasson has been awake since 3 o'clock in the morning when the legislation finally emerged. And it sounds like we're not going to shut down. After all of the talk we've had about that being essentially foregone, this is fascinating. Just clear the path, get rid of the rules. And we set a land speed record once again. That'll get us to September 30, by the way. The president has already dropped his 2025 budget proposal, and there are a lot of questions about whether this Congress is going to be capable of generating a spending plan beyond September, knowing that, well, forget just this two-week recess. Lawmakers are going into campaign season. Time to get reelected. And with a presidential campaign underway, nothing is going to be easy. Speaking of, been looking forward to talking to Laura today after we saw the numbers last night. Fundraising came in with the midnight deadline. So we're looking at Joe Biden's numbers and comparing them to Donald Trump's. And it is quite a contrast. She's our politics editor, of course, and a regular voice here on this program. Laura Davison, great to see you. Joe Biden is outraising Donald Trump by 2-1. You look at the polls and you try to wonder how to rationalize these two.
Yeah, this is a real, stark, you know, contrast. If you look at the polls, they are neck and neck. In some cases, Biden is trailing Trump. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to money, Biden has a significant lead over Trump. You look at kind of all the fundraising metrics, you know, in terms of the number of fundraisers, where this money's coming from, how much is coming in. And Biden's had a structural advantage. He's been able to raise money in conjunction with the DNC and the state parties, you know, since April of last year.
Okay.
Whereas Trump wasn't able to do that until, you know, a couple weeks ago. So he hasn't really seen that fundraising bump that he's able to get, you know, once he can, you know, combine powers with the RNC.
Well, let's just look at the numbers quickly here. So realizing it's not exactly apples to apples, but the campaigns themselves, Joe Biden's campaign raising $21.3 million in February, cash on hand, $71 million. Trump campaign, $11 million, cash on hand, $33 million. That's pretty stark. And the DNC pulling in $16 million to the RNC's $10 million does make you wonder here. He spent, what, more than $50 million on legal fees in this period of time.
About $5 million.
$5
million?
Well, so that's for the month.
For the month. Yes. $5 million for the month.
Overall.
Looking back to last January, you know, more than $60
million. So cash on hand would be a very different story if he wasn't spending everyone's money on attorneys.
Yeah, you know, he would have, you know, basically, you know, he has another $8 million or so that he can spend on legal fees. If he spent all of that legal fee money on the campaign, he'd be a lot better off in terms of this cash position, almost closing that gap with Biden. So that's a sort of an interesting way to think about this. The other thing that's really looming for Trump is he runs out of this money that he can use for legal fees, depending how quickly he spends it, 2-3 months, which means he then either has to use his own money, he has to go to the RNC, which means that there's less RNC money for races, or get more from donors, which just, you know, there is a finite amount of money out there.
That was by July or something, the cash burn would be a problem.
Even sooner now. He spent about twice as much in February as he did in January. So, you know, legal fees can be bumpy and don't necessarily follow a straight line.
Sure, yes. It's kind of amazing, though, because the big story is there might not be any trials before the election, and he's still burning cash. But I guess it costs a lot of money to delay these trials.
You know, there's, and he's got a multiple different legal fights he's fighting simultaneously. So that's lots of teams of lawyers, lots of hours. And, you know, he's these are expensive lawyers he's paying, you know, $2,000 an hour for.
As we spend time with Laura Davison on Bloomberg Radio and on YouTube, talk to me more about the RNC, because it has been reformed in his own image. He's even got Laura Trump in there, along with a very friendly co-chair, a Trump-friendly co-chair, and his senior advisor, La Civita, is helping to run the RNC now. They just have been there for a couple of weeks. What's that going to look like with some time and some momentum?
So they have basically cleaned house there. They've fired, you know, about 60 people. They have, you know, are reviewing every single contract that they have, and they are really embedding themselves and enmeshing themselves with the Trump campaign. So you have Chris La Civita, who is a key senior advisor at the Trump campaign, who's now the operations guy there. So you're going to see them moving in lockstep. You're already seeing this a little bit with some big fundraisers that are coming up. You know, John Paulson is holding one at the beginning of April. That, you know, the money we raised, you know, up to, you know, $800,000 a person.
Okay.
That money goes to the RNC, the state parties, as well as the Trump campaign. So they can soon, you'll start to see the money flowing in. The question is, are they able to sustain it?
Can they
catch up to Biden, which is, they've got, Biden has a huge lead right now.
You know, it's really interesting, Laura. We talk a lot about free media or earned media. Donald Trump is the king. He almost doesn't need to spend money. But when you think more about it and you listen to what Chris La Civita said about the cost of his rallies, which are really his secret weapon, right? These massive rallies, and he gets picked up and chopped up for social media. They cost so much money that they're pulling back on those. Could that be the real deficit for Trump in this cycle?
That could certainly end up being a problem for him. You know, right now he has no rallies on the calendar, and the plan going forward is to really cut back on the number of these they hold, be more choosy about, you know, locations, which could mean that they have, you know, less optimal locations, pull out fewer people.
Sure.
The other thing that's important for Trump is he has to expand his coalition. So the campaign is really going after Black voters, Hispanic voters, young voters, but it's going to take money to reach those people with your message and to have, you know, to bring out those people to the polls.
Joe Biden's touring swing states. That's what he's been doing since the State of the Union. That's what you do. The roadshow continues. He's trying like heck to connect with voters and create something that shows up in the polls. All Donald Trump has to do is go to court on Monday, which he will do, right? He'll be in court in New York, maybe get a new trial date from Alvin Bragg, and he will turn that into a snowballing media event. That is his home court advantage. The courtroom?
Yeah, and he will be able to control the message, and, you know, his message is, you know, look, this is a witch hunt, I'm being persecuted. Yeah. The other important thing to remember is next week is when he has to post that bond for the New York property case.
And what if he can't?
honestly, I don't know. But, you know, this is a ton of money.
That's
incredible. His properties, Letitia James has said she will seize some of his properties.
Oh, my God.
But that almost could be a massive fundraising moment for him of saying,
right.
Look,
taking
you know,
my buildings.
New York Democrats are taking my property.
Sure.
It could take that mugshot moment in Georgia when he had the mugshot and just, you know, totally blow that up to
that
even more fundraising.
Is incredible. Boy, I don't know. There's a lot here. When we consider Joe Biden's financial situation, as we started off here, in a commanding lead when it comes to dollars, how does he use that to his benefit? Are we going to be flooded with Joe Biden ads? Is it about organizing? How does he best use the money?
It's a combination of both. They have a big advertising strategy. So if you live in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Wisconsin, expect to be flooded with Joe Biden ads. Also a ton of organizing, a ton of get out the vote, and really sort of selling the message of why, you know, Joe Biden's economic policies work for folks, getting the right surrogates out to people. But, you know, they have a deficit in the polling. They're going to have to make that up. So that means you have to outspend and outwork your candidate, your opponent.
We're out of time, but there was a time when candidates would go underground in the summer and raise money until the convention, right? We're not going to get that, are we?
I'm sorry to report that's
They're
not going to happen
this year.
They're
just going to be beating the drum every day. We're going to be pulling you back in here to ask you what is going on. Laura Davison, great to see you. Great work, as always, here at Bloomberg on the Terminal and at Bloomberg.com. She edits the stories that you're reading about the campaign, including the fundraising totals that you can find a lot more on, as I mentioned, on the website and the terminal. Mike Dorning is going to come in to join us next with the latest on Capitol Hill. Can we avoid a shutdown? If we break the rules, we can. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Welcome to the Thursday edition of Balance of Power. It is truly the fastest show in politics today, the fastest hour. If you used to be with us in the old days, if you've been with us since Sound On, this will feel somewhat familiar. The best of Bloomberg, an hour-long show, news on a speedboat. And I say that because we have special coverage of the Reddit IPO coming next hour from Carol and Tim in New York. And when that does start trading, we'll, of course, have an update for you. Important headline I just want to mention because it crossed the terminal a short time ago. An Israeli team to travel to Qatar on Friday to advance a hostage deal. There's been a heck of a lot of talk about a potential ceasefire going on weeks now. And as Ramadan draws to its close, we could be onto something here. We'll see, having had the conversation between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu a bit earlier this week. Otherwise, it's all about funding the government after the bill dropped at 3 o'clock in the morning. Phones are ringing across town. 1,012 pages, $1.2 trillion. And some pretty upset conservative Republicans in the House who probably would have voted against this anyway, as we discussed earlier with Eric Wasson. But Mike Dorning is here. He's been all over this and editing our coverage here on Capitol Hill from Washington. It's great to see you, Mike.
Great to be here.
They got this thing done. I'm pretty sure you told us that they would avoid a shutdown, even when guys like me were ringing the bell. Your experience, I guess, has given you the ability to have patience.
Well, it's just like viewing things through a political lens.
Yep.
My view is, when there's a will, there's a way. And there was a lot of evidence that there was a will to avoid shutdown,
sure,
although they were still trying to find a way. And there's still a possibility we could have like a brief, inconsequential shutdown.
Yeah, right.
Where, I mean, obviously, if you have National Guard duty this weekend, that might be consequential because if they shut down, they don't do National Guard duty usually.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of the economy, people who are in the financial markets, it's possible they might miss this Friday midnight deadline by a few hours or a day or something, but it's not going to have any real impact on the overall economy or anything we invest in.
This is an interesting moment as the president urges swift passage of the spending deal, another headline crossing the terminal. as Mike Johnson makes the Freedom Caucus angry. We've heard some very tough reviews of this plan from the likes of Chip Roy and his colleagues, but we've stopped hearing about motion to vacate. Has he finally cleared that hurdle?
Well, we haven't heard any sign that any of them would be willing to do that. Yeah. And they've specifically said, some of them, we're unhappy, but we're not so unhappy we would have a motion to vacate. Mm-hmm. This motion to vacate is a fancy way of saying overthrow and leave leaderless the Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
And it hasn't really worked very well for them in terms of getting more done. And they're going into an election. They just need to focus on the election. So it's harder to do that. And their majority has even whittled down further since the days when they overthrew Kevin McCarthy. So I think that there is there's a reluctance to do that now.
Okay. After this happens, whether we get a couple hours or a couple days shut down here, they pass this, we're good till September 30th. Will there actually be action on the next fiscal year? I mean, the president's already dropped his 25 budget, or are we going to waste this whole summer running for office?
Well, there's the Ukraine funding that they don't have an agreement, but they're kind of circling around different ways that tells you that they are going to try something in April, whether that succeeds or not, we don't know, but probably it might succeed. But after that, it's mostly probably going to be either non-controversial things or messaging bills. And often what happens in an election is, even though the funding runs out on September 30th, they do a little kick the can down the road until after the elections, and then you know who's going to control everything next year. Mm-hmm. So you know who has power to make a deal.
Fascinating. Mike Dorning, great to have you with us, of course, editing our congressional coverage at a time when we thought we were heading for a shutdown. And again, we could still have a brief one, but it looks like the plan is in place here. And Speaker's got the votes, could take a minute in the Senate, and we'll see what happens after that. But thank you, Mike, of course.
Thank you.
Jumping in on the breaking story here, as always. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. This is Balance of Power. As we turn to the Federal Reserve meeting on this day after the Fed, we've had a chance to let things settle a little bit. Wall Street was certainly feeling good about things. And our friend Kate Davison was inside the lockup, as they call it, at the Treasury Department when they actually announced the decision. Of course, Michael McKee was in the news conference, and we spoke with him about the Q&A with Jay Powell. A lot of folks thought he'd come in hot and hawkish, and it didn't really feel like it by the time he was done. But I'm going to let Kate and bring her expertise on this and give us a sense of what she thinks. She leads our Federal Reserve coverage here in Washington. Happy Fed Day after. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Joe.
What did we learn yesterday? I know there was a tweak to the statement. We got a dot plot that people were obsessing over.
Right.
But the market seemed to love what it heard.
Yeah, I think markets were prepared for the Fed to say, we're not going to cut as many times this year as we thought at the end of 2023, which is the last time that they released their projections, the dot plot. And for now, they're holding firm, okay? The dots showed that there were actually 10 officials who think 3 rate cuts this year sounds about right. 9 of them think 2 or fewer. So it's like almost evenly split. There's 19 Fed officials. They all submit their projections. So even though, yes, they stuck with the forecast, it's pretty close. It sort of feels like things could go either way over the coming months.
There was a lot of concern because we've had some hot data lately, and in some cases hotter than expected, the job market, CPI. If that continues, are we going to be looking for adjustments in that forecast?
I think it's reasonable to think there could be some adjustments, right? So basically the message we heard from Jay Powell yesterday was that they're not overly concerned. They have said for many months that the path to 2% inflation will be bumpy. That is, they don't expect to see improvement, you know, month after month after month of improvement. There might be a couple blips. So now we saw a couple blips. And how concerned should we be about this? Right. And Powell was fairly, as you said, you know, markets really liked what he said, but it sounded to a lot of us who follow the Fed closely like he was trying to play it fairly down the middle, right? We're not super worried about this, but we're not taking it for granted that things are just going to be fine again, that this was just a blip.
Yeah, Michael McKee, our colleague, asked about that, whether it was, you know, kind of a one-off or if we're looking at a secular turn here. And I think the answer is we want to know that, too. They don't have that answer.
And that's the reason he said that he made this point again. That's the reason we're being careful and cautious and not rushing to cut rates, even though we've seen this big improvement in inflation. We still feel pretty good that things are on track. Nobody was saying, you know, that we shouldn't cut rates at all this year, or certainly no one's saying that we not need to think about hiking again. But there's no rush to do it. They want to be really sure.
Spending time with Kate Davidson here on Balance of Power. Is the market more aligned with the Fed now? I mean, we were pricing in madhouse compared to what Jay Powell was actually saying and what the Fed was projecting until somewhat recently. Are we more in line when it comes to the idea of 2 to 3 cuts this year?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems so, right? I don't think that the Fed chair yesterday was doing anything to try to adjust or push back on market expectations. Again, he repeated the line that we heard him say in January, that it will be appropriate to cut rates if the economy evolves as expected at some point this year.
Right.
That leaves him a lot of room, right, Joe? Right. Like, obviously, the thing about the dots is that there are only so many meetings, right? They'll meet on, they'll have a decision on May 1st, they'll have one in June, July, and then we're getting, you know, close to the end of the year. September, we have November meeting in December. So if they're going to go three times, and presumably, as we've heard a couple officials imply, maybe they want to go every other meeting. We don't really know what the cadence will be. But that starts to, I think the options for how they want this to proceed, the options start to get more limited the further along we get in the year.
I'm old enough to remember emergency rate moves, like between meetings. Wouldn't, doesn't he just want to do that for the thrill? Just go ahead. Just keep driving with an empty tank of gas, rip that thing out later this year, and declare victory.
I don't know if they're really going for thrills over there at the Fed. I think that's the opposite of what they want to do, right? Anything that's too exciting.
It is kind of amazing, though, because I have to admit, it sounds like you're telling me that the soft landing is going to happen or is happening.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't we all
love
to hear?
You're not allowed to answer that, though,
we'd
right?
all love to hear Jay Powell say, yes, we've done it. And lawmakers tried to get him to do that when he was on Capitol Hill. Like, they're just never going to do that. But look at those economic projections. I mean, we focus on the dot plot, the rate projections.
Yes,
but
right.
I think one of the really interesting things about yesterday was what we saw in their forecast for the economy. So they're still expecting to cut rates three times, maybe two. Mm-hmm. But they see much stronger economic growth this year. They see inflation, core inflation, a little bit higher than they thought it would be.
Sure.
When they met in December, and the unemployment rate a touch lower. So that's pretty
incredible.
It's pretty incredible, yeah.
Let it ride, I guess, is the story. Great to see you.
Thanks
for coming, as always. Kate Davidson helping us understand what Jay Powell's talking about and what might be coming next here when it comes to inflation.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Here I am in Washington, stuck in the swamp. But we got a bill that showed up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they're telling us they're going to break the rules and maybe get this thing done before the midnight deadline on Friday. And so we won't be talking about a government shutdown on Monday, but we'll just see about that. It could be a brief shutdown along the way, and we'll see how they do. It's a critical moment for Speaker Mike Johnson. And of course it is for Joe Biden for so many reasons. Good news today on fundraising, as we told you, outraising in the latest month Donald Trump by 2-1. And the administration is imposing new tailpipe emissions, which is a huge story that I feel like isn't getting enough coverage here. Imagine this. I mean, this is headline material. The strongest ever vehicle pollution standards in American history. And the idea is to get automakers to start selling more EVs and hybrids. The question is, will that work? Because that may not go exactly as planned. Jen DeLuey is with us, Bloomberg Energy and Environmental Policy Reporter. And Jen, it's great to have you back at the table.
Nice to be here.
This is a big one. We've had a lot of noise with shutdown politics and a lot of other stuff, but this is an awfully important story. and you could argue is really at the heart of the Joe Biden campaign message as part of Bidenomics. But we've seen this reluctance to move into EVs. How would this work, and how would automakers have to respond?
Well, these are fundamentally technologically neutral standards. They tell automakers you have to clean up your cars, you have to get rid of, you know, lower the greenhouse gas emissions and the soot and other stuff and the exhaust that makes the air dirty. But it's up to you to figure out how to do it. Realistically, practically speaking, that's going to be through plug-in hybrids. It's going to be through battery electric vehicles. Automakers say, we can make these cars. The question is, will there be enough charging? Will there be consumer adoption? Does the public really even want it? And that's one of the open questions as we go forward.
Absolutely. So we've seen some pretty interesting numbers here so far, despite the talk that EVs get. You crunch them in your story. Battery electrics now make up less than 8% of U.S. sales. Plug-in hybrids, barely 2%? Where would those numbers need to go?
Yeah, by 2032, you'd really have to see about two-thirds of cars and light trucks having a plug.
That's incredible. Is that possible?
Huge leap. Adoption is increasing still, despite some gloomy headlines out of the fourth quarter last year. You know, more of these cars are being sold even than conventional cars right now. The increase, rather, in sales is higher than the increase for conventional cars.
Yeah.
There's a lot of enthusiasm from some quarters for EVs that are going to get cheaper as battery prices come down.
Okay.
So there's a lot of enthusiasm in some quarters. Of course, there's a lot of people who are concerned about these rules and say they're
a
de facto
identity. Cheaper would unlock a lot, right? That's the first thing you hear. Maybe after range, to your point, people have concerns about the charging network, but it's the cost that keeps, it's a high barrier to entry. So obviously the administration is trying to do that. I'm fascinated by the reaction of by automakers. Clearly this is not the type of thing they want to hear, but they were applauding the addition of hybrids, which seems like a very important part of this story. We've actually seen hybrids outselling EVs recently in terms of what people are comfortable buying.
Right. Plug-in hybrids in particular have taken, you know, grown in interest. And, and that is, even though it's a more expensive setup, you've got two drivetrains instead of just a battery electric approach. You know, they're clearly positive for consumers who are worried about range, who are worried about finding that next charging station. And so obviously Detroit and the automakers really wanted this flexibility. And they got it. They got a final rule that was easier to comply with than than the initial proposal.
And that was a healthy round of lobbying. How did they get it done?
I think the fact that the United Auto Workers striked last year and made clear that they were concerned about the pace of the transition.
Sure, yeah.
That was a factor here. For the EPA, getting the automakers on board, to be sure they're concerned. They think this is a challenge. A lot has to go right.
Mm-hmm.
But getting automakers to at least, you know, clap a little bit means that these rules are more durable. They're more likely to not get a challenge from the auto industry and to withstand the test of time.
Because we're talking about them changing their lineups, essentially, right? This is, if you're going to essentially force consumers to buy EVs, you need to stop selling cars with gas engines.
Right. If you're, you can have gas models clearly under this rule, but
just
you're going to have
fewer
to offset. Exactly. And you know, the concern that opponents raise is that means those cars are going to be more expensive. They're going to be harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
And in some areas of the country, they may be what you really need, certainly over the next few years.
Hmm. Is this coupled with enhancements maybe from the infrastructure law to extend and make the charging network more continuous?
Right. We are benefiting from, and this industry will benefit from, tremendous money that's coming out of both the infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act.
Okay.
That's going into chargers. Obviously, that's also supporting some battery manufacturing in the U.S.
Yeah.
All of that's supposed to help basically bring this infrastructure along.
Because you can't have one without the other, I guess, here. But you know how politics works. If Donald Trump came back to the White House, this all gets wiped away as an executive action, right?
Indeed. I mean, this is an EPA rulemaking. They would have to go through the process of undoing it, which is something he did last time.
Sure.
And so it might take a few years. But the fact that automakers are buying into this revised schedule will help.
And that's important, though. A few years, that means they're going to be altering, they're going to be retooling their factories already by then, which might be incentive to keep it in place.
You know, they prefer some certainty, and I think that's an argument that you would hear them make if Trump is elected and wants to disband this. Now, to be clear, you know, President Trump might not care too much about what the automakers want. He may also, be looking to consumer support and what consumers and voters want.
You wonder, look, it's going to be wherever the wind is blowing, I guess, at that moment. But with his appeal to UAW members, you mentioned the union. Those are a lot of Trump voters not into this EV transition, or at least an accelerated, incentivized transition. And running against this is music in Detroit, right?
It cuts different ways.
Yeah.
Clearly, this was softened partly to deal with those UAW concerns. I mean, the pitch that the president is making is, look, this is the future of the industry. The future of cars is electric. Yep. Do we in the U.S. want to make those cars, or do we want to let China compete against us to take our market share? Mm-hmm. And so that's the compelling argument that the president is trying to advance and went over Detroit with.
You wonder how Elon Musk feels about this. Not a big fan of this administration, and frankly, this administration hasn't been terribly friendly to him. He's not invited to a lot of EV events that we've seen where GM and Ford and others are lauded. It's kind of funny, though, this whole thing about the hybrids. I guess Toyota was ahead of its time, right? The Prius is an old car, but this is what people want.
The plug-in hybrids make people excited.
That's hysterical. Jen, great reporting. Thank you for coming on to talk to us
about
it.
Thank you very much.
The strongest ever vehicle pollution standards in U.S. history. That's saying something. We'll see how it plays here. Keep your eyes on the terminal if you want to read more about it. Jen DeLouis did a great job with her colleagues here in the newsroom in moving this forward. I have to talk about Donald Trump before we go away. By the way, we are getting an update on Reddit. It looks like trading will begin a little bit closer to 1 o'clock, a little bit closer to the top of the hour here. And when it does, wall-to-wall coverage, roadblock coverage here on Bloomberg. Just stand by. The building will shake when this thing starts trading. I've got it up in front of me, and we're waiting. But Donald Trump, he's got an interesting week ahead, and I didn't want to miss out on this. Remember, there was a trial that was supposed to begin on Monday. It's the Bragg trial in New York, Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen, hush money. Not going to start on time because of a big evidence dump. We talked about that. Thousands of documents dumped recently, and we're going to get at least a month delay in the start of that trial. But Donald Trump still has to be in court, or does he? There's still going to be a hearing on Monday, and he is going to attend. I'm not sure it's mandatory. But we could get a trial date then. We're also going to be waiting to see if he can meet bond in a separate trial next week. He's been warning that he may not. And that's why we bring in Eric Larson for help. Bloomberg legal reporter with us now on Balance of Power. Eric, great to see you. I'm curious, we'll pick through these one at a time. What's going to happen on Monday? Will we get a new trial date?
It is certainly possible. We don't know for sure if the judge will get to that. He has a lot of other issues to get to first, which you alluded to regarding that evidence dump. Trump's defense argues that they got tens of thousands of documents related to the case too late. The Manhattan District Attorney, which brought this case, argues that, yes, the documents did come late, and this 30-day delay that you mentioned is sufficient to look at those documents, but that their review so far shows that not many of them are actually relevant, and that this suggestion that the document dump is a huge problem is completely overblown. So we'll have arguments on both sides of that on Monday, and as you said, Trump will be there.
Does he actually need to go, Eric?
I'm sorry?
Does he need to attend, or is that a campaign event?
My understanding is that he needs to attend all of these hearings, and that we are expecting him to be there.
Got it. Fascinating. I need to ask you about the bond here in the separate. This is the civil fraud lawsuit, a $454 million judgment against Donald Trump. He's warning that he may not be able to make bond on this. And I'm hearing from terminal users here, Eric, and of course others as we talk about this in the newsroom and with our listeners and viewers, what happens if he can't make it? Are we actually going to be in a world where Letitia James starts seizing Donald Trump's properties?
That's correct. And the state, I believe, is already gearing up for that. This is a judgment that has been handed down by a court following an 11-week trial. Trump is, of course, appealing it, but is required to post a bond for the full amount, actually 120% of the amount, while he appeals. That's just standard. So he's trying to get an appeals court to waive that requirement. But if the court doesn't step in and do that by Monday, this deadline, then the state has every right to legally try to get that money through other means. And this case, seizing assets. It's a process that could be dragged out in court and start a whole new court process. But it would start with the attorney general putting liens on various properties. We don't know exactly which ones she might target, but clearly she has said she will do this. And Monday is probably when she would start that process.
Absolutely incredible. So March 25th is the deadline. Again, 120% of a $454 million judgment. Trump's legal team says he does not have that money. Is that fair to say, Eric?
Yes. They've said that between this verdict and their earlier one of the E. Jean Carroll case, which was an $83 million judgment, they did post a bond in that case. But between those two verdicts and just the cash that Trump says he needs to have on hand to run his business, they said that he just doesn't have anywhere near enough. So the problem is that these companies that arrange these bonds, their insurance companies, they won't take his real estate as collateral, and they only want cash. So the state seems to be thinking that they might actually have to follow through on this seizure process. They even filed this judgment with Westchester County near New York. They filed it in the judgments and lien sections of the clerk's office there, which was sort of paves the way for them to try to go after Trump's properties in Westchester County. And he has a couple of big ones there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we're talking about Trump National Golf Club, Westchester. And as you report, the mostly undeveloped, more than 200-acre Seven Springs estate. Are those the two most likely targets?
Yes, I believe so. And, the Seven Springs estate is pretty interesting as well, because it really did feature quite a bit in this 11-week trial in which Trump was accused of inflating his asset valuations by billions of dollars a year for over a decade so he could get better terms on loans from banks. So Seven Springs is a property that he had acquired with hopes of doing a big development on that. He bought it in 1995.
Well, it may never begin. Apparently. Eric, thank you. We'll check in with you Monday. We'd love to, at least. Eric Larson, Bloomberg legal reporter, with a lot on the line next week for Donald Trump. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.